listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg wrapped up a two-day trip to London on Friday. He warned that the military alliance could be under threat if the U.S. and its European allies failed to settle some pending disputes. Press TV's Amina Taylor filed this report from London.
NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg is warning that straining ties between the U.S. and its European allies are putting at risk 70 years of peaceful relationships and could risk the transatlantic and military alliance. Stoltenberg was in London to deliver that message in a series of high-profile meetings that included talks with the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson and Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May.
Yes, we see differences between the United States and other allies over issues such as trade, climate, and the Iran nuclear deal. And there are disagreements within Europe too, over the future direction of the European Union, over values and populism. These disagreements are real. It is not written in stone that the transatlantic bond will survive forever.
The British Prime Minister was keen to stress Britain's status within NATO.
And the reports that you have read are not correct. We will continue to be, as we have been discussing today, continue to be, as I said earlier, that leading contributor to the alliance, but also a leading defence nation.
Despite the cries of unity, there are pressing issues to be clarified when it comes to the very future of NATO, including funding for the organisation and the role and influence of its members.
There are internal disputes at the moment within NATO, that is very clear, and the main issue is how much members of NATO are spending on their defence sector each year. And I believe that Mr. Stoltenberg feels, perhaps fears, that this dispute amongst NATO members is playing into the hands of Russia, because Mr. Stoltenberg has made very, very clear that NATO is being challenged and the country challenging NATO is Russia.
Despite describing Russia as, quote, a common challenge to NATO members, the General Secretary was keen to play down any sense of antagonism between the two powers. Both Jens Stoltenberg and Theresa May represent institutions that are in dire need of international alliances. Both the British government and NATO must be aware that closer ties with the United States may well hold the key to their international fortunes, for better or for worse.
With the NATO summit taking place in Brussels in a matter of weeks, NATO and its allies will hope to positively address some of the pressing issues. But with recent history to go by, expect some political surprises. Amina Taylor, Press TV, London.
At least 8 people were reported killed in Syria following an airstrike by U.S.-led forces in Deir el-Zor province, according to state television in Damascus. The airstrike targeted the village of al-Sha'afa, destroying a number of houses, as well as public infrastructure, according to the Syrian Arab news agency, Sana'a. U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said Thursday that Washington was, quote, deeply troubled by reports of increasing Syrian regime operations, closed quote, in southwest Syria that followed government moves to regain control of some rebel-held areas. Washington said it would take, quote, firm and appropriate measures, closed quote, in response to what it claimed were government violations of the de-escalation deal it brokered with Russia last year to attempt to contain the conflict in the southwestern part of the country. Thursday's strike followed another attack by coalition aircraft in which they reportedly bombed Syrian military positions in the al-Bukamal area of Deir el-Zor province. When Sana'a reported on the strike, citing a military source who said there were fatalities and injuries, the Pentagon denied involvement, saying it was, quote, not a U.S. or coalition strike, closed quote. Some media reports, citing U.S. officials, blamed Israel for the attack. One area of contention among the parties involved in the war in Syria has been the repeated claims of the use of chemical weapons by various sides. Early Friday, Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Ministry of Defense held a joint briefing in Moscow to discuss some of the problems they've faced during investigations of the use of chemical weapons in Syria. This is Russia's Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova, followed by Major General Igor Kirillov, commander of the Radiological, Chemical, and Biological Defense Forces of the Russian Federation.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. We're glad to welcome you at this joint briefing held together by the Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia. This briefing is being held in Park Patriot, which is well known to all Russians, and I hope that with your assistance as well, as our briefing is oriented on the representatives of diplomatic missions in Moscow, it will be known better to our foreign colleagues, partners, and friends. It's not an occasional place from the point of view of selecting it, so we will refer to it later. And I would like to say that today, on the 22nd of June, in Russia, we know this day is a day of sorrow and memory because the Second World War, Great Patriotic War, started this day. We'll have official events, and today Russian people commemorate those, remember those who did not return from this war. We were not doing this intentionally, but I think it's kind of symbolical that this event is held on this day. Today the world is going through hard times. It's not about one country or some regions, and Russian leadership spoke about it many times, and a lot has been said on the international platforms. The world is going through transformation. This transformation, of course, affects the international relations and the world we live in, its foundations, the legal framework were founded as a result of the Second World War. And the future of this world, its appearance depends into our probably and primarily from those people who are involved in military and diplomatic issues, the diplomats, the experts. So today, this traditional event will be used for us to provide you with the materials and our estimates of what is happening in Syria from the point of view of chemical issues. We have materials which deserve to be demonstrated today. In particular, to the left of me, to the right from you, you can see the equipment and the leaks about this equipment appeared a few days ago. And the world is like that. The information is impossible to hide. This question was asked in our briefing in Samara, and I said that we'll do everything possible to answer this question. With facts in our hands, you have these facts, you can see them. And today, representatives of the Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Foreign Affairs invited you to speak about a very important issue having these facts in hand, which is, and I would like to say it once more, our meeting is interactive. I'd like to say it once again, and you will have a chance to ask questions. I'm speaking about the representative of diplomatic missions. Our meeting is about the use of chemical weapons in Syria. I would also like to say that this problem will go deeper into details about this problem today, but I'd like to say that what you see is real equipment used by the guerrillas, by terrorists. It was found in Duma, the city of Duma. Now the investigation is taking place, who of the terrorists were using that. On one hand, that's a handmade little plant, but it is semi-professional, and regardless of the fact we're speaking about guerrillas and terrorists, I cannot say with 100%, being sure 100%, I cannot give you specific information who specifically was using that from the guerrillas and from the terrorists. That's still a matter of investigation. I would like to focus your attention that this part, which from point of view of experts, is a professional equipment, unfortunately, was produced in the countries of Western Europe. There is no proven it. We are ready to provide specific information, work in order to our colleagues if they are interested in it, and I think there are no other variants about that, and demonstrate the proof that indeed, unfortunately, this equipment was provided to terrorists from the Western Europe. As for introduction from my side, I think I would conclude on that, and I will give the floor directly to Igor Anatolievich Kirillov. You perfectly know him very well, and many times in this very place, and he was delivering speeches in front of diplomatic representatives. Ladies and gentlemen, the Russian Federation has a specific position that the use of chemical weapons should not be done, and everybody who uses that has to be punished. Russia has fulfilled an obligation and destroyed its chemical weapons. At the same time, U.S., Great Britain, and France are confusing international community and facing confrontation. They blame Syrian Arab Republic in violating the convention and Russian contribution with it. On this background, the campaign was launched on turning the OPCW in a political structure, having the power to introduce strict blaming verdicts towards specific states and its leaders. members. The mission of OPCW is play a certain role there, which has its investigations and consultations with U.S. and its allies. The investigation of alleged incidents in Sarakhib, Shekhun, and Tamina, without visiting the location, speaks about non-professionalism of that. Not by chance they use such words like likely, probably, allegedly, etc. The language which is which should not be used for a serious document based on serious proofs. The analysis and use of documents which were obtained without experts going to the places of alleged use of chemical weapons directly contradicts to the provisions of the convention. Is it a norm that the only source of proof are the opposition or non-governmental organizations, white casks, Syrian American medical community, Syrian Center of Fixing Chemical Violations? These proofs are doubtable, bearing in mind that white casks are assisting to such terrorist organizations as Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, and Jaish al-Islam,
which
officially announced the use of chemical weapons. During the investigation of this incident, they violated the basic principle of chain of custody, which implies strict consequence of actions to preserve the proof. Violation of standards of OPCW led to contradictions in facts in the reports of the investigations, which have brightly anti-Syrian, specific anti-Syrian character. One of the most well-known episodes is the provocation of white casks on 4th April 2017 in Khan Sheikhoun, wherein they used the scenario of imitation of chemical weapons. Americans used this provocation, not waiting to the end of the investigation and the Security Council investigation. They made an air strike on Sharat base, and after that the mission started investigation in distance, and after 3 months it provided the report. The report showed that characteristics of the science were witnessed that the explosives were located on the ground but not dropped from the aircraft, and after that the traces of explosives were covered with concrete. And then the video materials and where people are demonstrated without special protection of breath and skin, it speaks about lack of xerine in it, because in case if it was a chemical charge, people would be immediately damaged, both those who were assisting to the victims and the victims themselves. Then those suffered have no signs of phosphor. After 1 year, white casks, white helmets repeated the same scenario on the 7th of April 2018 in Duma. I'd like to say that Russian experts analyzed everything about this incident and came to the conclusion that this one more fake footage. We figured out that in two apartments there were found gas containers allegedly dropped by governmental forces. At the same time, there was a number of doubtful things. First of all, there are no deformation on the containers. If they were dropped from 2,000 meters, they would have been damaged. After drop of that, the interior was intact. The bed where it was allegedly dropped was also intact. The It was delivered from the street, and there were no victims, no dead, and no casualties. They were sealed only 1.5 months after the inspection came. What result we can expect in investigation of this incident, which already led to massive rocket missile shelling performed by the U.S., Great Britain, and France, violating international norms. They're allegedly preparing one more report with pseudo proofs. As for assistance to the victims of chemical attack, Russian side brought the witnesses of this briefing to Hague, where they saw the convictional, the proofs of this provocation. I want to say that on the eve of the special session of the conference of member states of OPCW, called by the initiative of Great Britain, the US, and France, they brought two more doubtable incidents which were previously not mentioned, which they say was on 4th February 2018 in Sarakip, 24th, 25th and 30th of March 2017 in El Latana. By this comfortable practice, the mission of the OPCW held a comfortable distance investigation and prepared a report and came to a conclusion that in the suburbs of Sarakip was allegedly used as the chemical weapon course, which was spread mechanically. Two laboratories of OPCW, which analyzed the samples of the white helmets, came with contradictory conclusions. Organic components of wood was found in 14 samples by one laboratory, and the other laboratory didn't find a single one. Also, there were traces of explosives in a number of samples, but witnesses spoke about no explosions which took place. Two laboratories identified the list chemicals of list 2 of the convention, where chlor has nothing to do with. At the same time, there is no full match of the analysis of samples. FFM does not consider this fact. They say that literally, there are chemicals in the samples which cannot be explained as naturally found in the environment and relating to chloride. They were allegedly brought there by white casks which provided the samples to the FFM. The mission was postponing the investigation to accommodate the U.S. and their allies. And the final report on the incident in El Tamna was published 18 months after it allegedly happened, only to promote this fact, to promote the decision of the pseudo-court functions providing them to OPCW to find those guilty and to convict them. The experts of FFM said that on the southern outskirts of El Tamna, on 24th, 30th of March 2017, with high probability, Zarin was used. And on 25th March of 2017, they say allegedly chloride was used. Incidents of 24th and 30th of March 2017. The shell crater does not match with the shell crater typical for aviation shell, and it is imitated by white casks in Khan Shaykhun. The conclusion of FFM that it was chemical is not proved by any proofs. We made analysis of photos. There we can see fragments of strong corrosion of regular high explosive bomb, but not a chemical one. This munition parts were lying there not less than 5 years in the open, regardless of various meteorological, ballistical and other conditions. The results of analysis of samples of Oledamne and Han Shih-Hun are practically identical. White helmets used some standard mixture to falsify the situation. The report also says that the representatives found four biometrical samples, and they showed the absence of biomarkers of cesium. Though it is obvious, this factor is used to be used in cesium, like 6.3 of the report. In this context, it is important to recognize that not being able to find biomarkers relating to exposure of organophosphate nor of agents may signify no exposure. Similarly, there are scientific reasons why these biomarkers may not be detected, principally due to the significant time lapse between potential exposure and collection, sample amount, and limit of detection of the analytical methods. That's going from the report. So we have to state that once more, procedure of medical probes and samples was violated, like in the case of Skripali. We remember situation. All the media said that the mission which came to Salisbury was looking for samples. A point of report number 18. The samples were taken by personnel in the hospital with the use of equipment of the OPCW. The incident on 25th of March 2017. Alleged use of chloride is explained by the appointed laboratories found a set of chloro organic components. In fact, based from the list, most of them are trichlorphenol, which is antiseptic and is present in the samples from the hospital. It's quite reasonable in this situation. Parallel to chloro organic components, the degradation product of zarin was found. The reporters do not connect it with the use of zarin and explain it that degazation by water was performed in this premise to those who suffered on 24th of March 2017. In this case, we have a question. Where are the other components of zarin found in the samples referring to this incident?
Where did they take it? According to our opinion, it was deliberately put into the samples in order to discredit the Syrian army. It once again demonstrates that FFM conducts investigation as it pleases. It has nothing to do with the objectiveness, neutrality, and impartiality. In the territory of Syria, the specialists and experts of the chemical protection forces have repeatedly discovered the clandestine chemical laboratories and warehouses of toxic chemicals. Today we discovered more than 40 tons of the poisonous and toxic agents. We repeatedly asked to send experts on the ground, but they said that these 40,000 tons have been used for the documentation of the pools. We also identify the warehouse and specialized laboratory for the production of the chemical toxic agents. We provided these samples to the OPCW experts, but they were of no interest. This equipment is before you. This equipment, they produced highly technological, high-quality explosive 10. And we discovered also tiadiglycol и диэталамин, which could be used for the production of the sulfur and nitrogen mustards. And we have evidence of the application, and also as hexamine, which is a stabilizing additive for xerene. Besides, we identify the cylinder with chlorine, which is used to imitate the chemical attack. This equipment implements the final stage of fusion of blister agents. This part is produced in the European countries. The constructive position of the Syrian Arab Republic and Russia are confirmed by the efforts which were undertaken in order to provide the comprehensive assistance and help to FFM in investigation in Duma. But we expect to see another anti-Syrian report. I would like to draw your attention to the fact that Syria is that in Syria eliminates all poisonous chemicals, and it was awarded, this organization was awarded with the Nobel Prize, and Syria is making every possible effort to complement all the obligations assumed in the limitation of the facilities. And Syrians eliminated on June 8, 2018, one of the chemical production facility, and it was the OPCW said that they need to organize a tender in order to eliminate the chemical production facilities. And in conclusion, I would like to say that the Russian Federation is also trying to operate the specific facts and arguments. But our partners are always trying to shy this consideration. On the contrary, Russia is caring about the reputation of while trying to organize to overcome systematic failures and avoiding the politicization and prejudice in its work.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. All across the Western world, the so-called melting pot is melting down. Immigration, legal and illegal, is probably the most contentious and divisive issue energizing voters. In Italy, for example, the right and left have united on the issue. In Germany, the government may collapse. And Trump has made this his signature cause. Can the status quo be sustained? Crosstalking Immigration, I'm joined by my guest John Laughlin in Paris. He's a historian and specialist in international affairs. In Bolzano, we have Roland Benedictor. He is the co-director of the Center for Advanced Studies of Eurex Research. And in Hurghada, we have Ralph Niemeyer. He is a German journalist and author. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I'd like to go to John first in Paris. I'd like to just kind of kick this whole discussion off by an observation I've had over the last few weeks and months, particularly with the events going on in the United States, is it appears that virtue signaling has replaced policy and debate, because all we're supposed to do is to think emotionally about this and not use our heads. And I think this is what the establishment media and establishment parties want us to think that way, to address this issue. And if we stop virtue signaling, maybe we could come up with some solutions. Your thoughts, John?
Well, there's a lot of propaganda involved, isn't there, Peter? I mean, we've just seen in the events on the Mexican border these very propagandistic pictures of children are supposedly being separated from their parents. I'm sure your viewers will remember the picture of the poor little Kurdish boy on a Turkish beach, the dead body of a little boy. He was a victim of the migration crisis, and the broadcast of his photo was used to elicit sympathy for the plight of migrants, and it worked very well. But when a boy of the same age was killed in a terrorist attack in Barcelona, the policy was not to show his dead body out of respect for him and for his family. So we can see that these images are being used to drive a political agenda. And that is the problem. The problem is that this immigration is being driven by a political agenda. It is being driven by a political agenda of European states who are demographically weak. The demographic pyramid is inverted. There are more old people than young people. And for many years and decades now, economists and policymakers have decided that in order to rectify this demographic problem in Europe, we need immigration. We need to bring in people from outside in order to pay our pensions. And that is the immigrationist ideology. And as long as that ideology remains in place, as long as the ideology is believed by these people, as it is most notably in Germany, then I'm afraid the problem will continue.
Okay, Roland, you know, the thing is that this is approach with open borders. But if you believe that there are open borders, then there are no borders to defend. I think that's the paradox of what's happening in the Western world. You want to have open borders, let people come in, but then you can't defend a border when it's necessary. Go ahead, Roland.
Well, look, there is no such thing like a political entity or a community without borders, never in history. And you need borders. Why? Because you have to define the limits of validity of your laws. And that is what the leftist school, the Frankfurt School, Jürgen Habermas says, what the system theory says. So borders are something good and not something bad. What we had in Europe over the past decades was a very strongly leftist-oriented political correctness, which believed in a cosmopolitan definition of identity. And as, for example, the standing group identity itself of the European Consortium on Political Research in Paris and in Brussels would say today, is that we need to define our identity as Europeans much more in a European way,
right,
and in a less exaggerated cosmopolitan way, because we cannot live without borders, because if you have no borders, you have no rule of law and no definition where your laws are valid and where not.
Okay, Ralph, let me go to you. I mean, okay, we have a lot of consensus here. The media is for open borders. The political class is for open borders. But you know what? The voters aren't for open borders. And we're seeing it in election after election. I mean, isn't it time that democracy be recognized again in the European Union? I mean, we have the Austrians, we have the Italians, we have also a new, I could use the term fifth column in Germany right now, that it's waking up to what voters want. And they're running on these issues. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yes, of course it's true that the open border myth, I must say, of leftists, and I am calling myself a leftist, is at stake, because it has not worked out fine. And we left behind those people who already live in our country, and we did not take care of them. Although refugees had nothing to do with the fact that the pensions were not good enough anymore. This was due to privatization of the pension scheme, or that the wages are not good enough, or that the rent is too high for apartments. This is all not due to the refugee crisis, but it came up with that now, that people are realizing that they were left behind, and they say, hang on a minute, now foreigners are coming as well. So this is where the leftists made a key mistake in the recent years, and especially when 2015 happened, when Mrs. Merkel once and for all did a decision, said, wir schaffen das, we are going to manage, in English. Then people said, yeah, but why don't we manage with ourselves first? And of course, this is where right-wing and nationalistic parties are coming up now, because they take voter sentiment serious, where leftists have failed to do that, and especially the German leftists have failed completely in that. They still demand open borders, like if there were no borders and no states, which is, of course, not true. there are states, and we need states, of course, and otherwise we have anarchy, and no one wants to live in anarchy. And I think this is also what brings down the Merkel government now, because she lost control.
Yeah, but John, you know, the interesting thing is that these waves of migrants or asylum seekers or whatever term you want, because it seems to me most of them, vast majority of for economic immigrants here. But, you know, they don't really come in on Lear jets, do they, to Germany? They don't, you know, they don't fly into airports. They kind of walk through the continent. You know, and that's what makes me feel really bad for the Greeks and the Italians. OK, I mean, if Germany wants those people, fine, but it's not being done the right way, even according to EU laws. Okay, so I mean, Germany cannot be the decision maker of immigration in Europe. That is intensely anti-democratic and against the rules of the European Union. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the rules are being broken, because indeed Germany, by saying that a million refugees are welcome and then by trying to offload them onto other members of the European Union, was indeed breaking refugee law and breaking the European Union's own rules, that's for sure. I'm in strong agreement with what Roland said about borders and the need to protect them, but I have a different conclusion. I disagree that this is a European problem, and indeed I think that that this can be solved with European measures. And I think that the reflex position of European leaders, which is to say that we need a European solution to this problem, is precisely wrong. It is precisely the fact that we have a European Union with a borderless internal space, the Schengen area, which has caused the migration problem in the first place. I first visited the Songat camp near Calais late 1990s. The migration crisis that we're talking about now didn't start in 2015. It started in the 1990s when Italy joined the Schengen zone. And from that moment onwards, the borders of the Mediterranean were on the English Channel.
Yeah.
And there is a direct relation of cause and effect. And what we saw in 2016, after Hungary and Croatia and the other countries built fences to close off the Balkan route, is that national solutions are the ones that solve this problem, not European ones. And we are now, I hope, seeing the same result with the Italians, who are taking matters into their own hands nationally, defending their national territory. And it's only by doing that, because they have the navy, they have the ability to do it, that this solution will end. Prior to the imposition of national solutions, the habit was, and it's a very bad structural problem in the EU, it was that countries would simply let the migrants in, like Greece and Italy, and then send them north to Germany. In other words, there were beggar thy neighbour policies,
right,
which is a structural problem in the EU. So I think we need to finish with this idea that the solution is European, the problem is European.
Roland, the argument that the left and the media have made is that, and it's already been mentioned in this program, I think it was you, demographics, the need for workers, new workers. But, I mean, looking at the evidence, I don't see a lot of these migrants, particularly since 2015, are employed across the European Union. They do take state benefits. And in most of the countries of the European Union have austerity, so you have very large youth unemployment. So why this impulse to keep bringing in more people, unless it's just cheap labor? Go ahead, Roland.
Yeah, indeed, this is a myth, especially if we take into account the current trend toward automatization. Large parts of the traditional labor force, especially blue-collar workers, will be dismissed over the coming years. And unfortunately, most of those who come in an irregular ways to Europe do not have an education, do not have any kind of qualification. And a recent study of the European Ministry of Labour admitted that it was very difficult to qualify more than 20 to 25% of all coming over the coming years to get a job. And in fact, the job acceptance rate, employment rate of migrants and refugees is very low. So this is indeed a problem, and this is a myth that is partly to be dismissed, because it will always less correspond to the truth. But let me just say something to my previous speaker. I'm in many ways of his opinion that we need a dramatic change in the immigration policy, because we cannot go on like this. And I think more and more Europeans have understood this, as the recent elections all over Europe have shown.
Okay.
Gentlemen,
I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on immigration. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Roland. You want me, right before we went to the Rick, you wanted to finish your point. Please do.
Yeah, just wanted to say that I'm not of the same opinion in one crucial point, which is I think we need more Europe and not less Europe to solve the crisis. And I give you a practical example. Today, we have to harmonize the asylum laws, and that is the most urgent issue to solve. Today, it is possible that a migrant that is not accepted in one country, for example, in Germany, can just switch country and restart applying in another country, for example, in Italy or in France. And if he or she doesn't succeed there, they just switch on and go further. We have to harmonize the laws to accept asylum seekers. We have to harmonize the registration. And, of course, we have to harmonize the declaration of secure third countries of origin. For example, Germany has declared parts of Afghanistan a secure country and doesn't accept asylum seekers. They just switched to Italy and are accepted because Italy has not declared parts of Afghanistan as secure. So we have urgently to find transnational European solutions for these problems. Otherwise, we will not be able to stop the crisis.
Okay, I can see in Paris John is really disagreeing. Let me go to Ralph real quick. But it seems to me that, Roland, you want to create the United States of Europe. And everything to date shows that's not what people want. No one ever asked the Europeans if they ever wanted that. Ralph, let me go to you. A very important issue that isn't being brought up here, and this applies to the United States and Europe, is that there are criminal gangs making a fortune off of this scam, okay? Bringing people in there. NGOs, you know, the do-gooders. But no, they're blinded by ideology. They're ideologically possessed. They have a hatred for their own culture, a hatred for Europe. They want to just wipe it away and fill it up with foreign alien people. I'm sorry to sound so politically incorrect, but that is true. Particularly the criminal gangs in the Mexican border and all through the Mediterranean. You have a lot of people preying on some very weak people. And I'd like to point out also that it's often forgotten, the people that do want to immigrate to the United States and to Europe, they should stay in their own country and build their own country, okay? Instead of having the West have to subsidize them in their home country where they left. Okay, that's a lot said right there. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, well, I do agree to a certain extent, because I once raised that question even in a press conference with Mrs. Merkel, and she made the same mistake that many people do at this. Also, in our discussion, I hear now that we mix migration issues with asylum. You know, to uphold the asylum, the right of asylum, which is a human right, and we have to uphold that for those who need it, we cannot mix that issue with migration. Now, what I do agree with is that what we see at the moment at the Mexican border is probably set up by deep state or by some people who want to make Mr. Trump act, and Mr. Trump is not falling for it because he remembers what happened to Mrs. Merkel when she suddenly had the refugees coming in, and this was advertised as the Balkan route by the media. Now, at the beginning of this year, sometime in spring, I watched a program on CNN, where there was a colleague on a bus tour from Central America towards the U.S. border and reporting from it and advertising it, kind of saying, oh, this is the way to go to the United States. Of course, you can instigate that. Yeah. And obviously, Mr. Trump is facing this now. Nobody wants to see these crying children and parents being arrested and all that. I don't think that he wants to see that. But it's now a fact that they want to carry him over a red tape. Like they did with Mrs. Merkel, and then it was the only two times she only governed in the last 12 years. Was one decision was about a financial crisis, and she pumped billions into ailing banking systems. The second decision she made during her 12-year reign was in 2015 to say, okay, these people sleeping on train stations, they can come. But after that, she lost control. And this is why people are voting for right-wing parties. And leftists do make the mistake, especially in Germany, I see that they do not have an answer to these sentiments of people We are able to take many more refugees. It's not a problem because we are a rich country. But we have to take care of the people who are already in Germany first, and then we can say we can accept migrant workers. But asylum should be always be separate from that because there is no limit to that. That's a human right.
You know, John, a lot has been said since you last spoke there, and I can read your mind this far away that more Europe is not the solution, juxtaposition what our friend Roland had to say. Go ahead, John.
Yes, I wanted to come back to that point in response to the question you asked about the economic rationale. You rightly put your finger on the paradox that immigration is justified economically because it keeps wages down and gives a supply of cheap labour and so on. But that in reality, of course, many of the migrants end up being out of work. And in any case, there's a lot of youth unemployment in Europe. By asking that question, Peter, you have highlighted the point I made in my first answer, namely that the ideological reasons that I referred to, which are European, are not motivated by economic good sense. We can have a debate about whether or not you need cheap labour. Britain, by the way, is an economic model for that because Britain has imported millions of low-cost workers from Poland and Romania since 2004, and we've seen the effects of that on the economy, an increase in GDP and a collapse in productivity. But that's not what's driving the immigration ideology. It's precisely not economic rationale. It is instead ideology. You know, it's important to recall that one of the founding fathers of the European integrationist movement, Richard von Coudenhove-Kalergi, in 1925 called for the races of Europe to be mixed with other bloods, for the European race to be mixed with other bloods in order to create a new European of the future. He had a sort of racialist view, except the other way around from the Nazis. Right. He wanted racial mixity, racial diversity. And this idea, which he first published in 1925, he's a big figure. He was the first president of the Council of Europe, for example. This idea remains alive today in the minds of European leaders, particularly, incidentally, German ones. Wolfgang Schäuble, now president of the Bundestag, for many years the German Minister of Finance, said in an interview in Die Zeit in 2016 that if we didn't have migrants and we kept them out, then Europe would descend into incest. He used the word incest. And similarly, the German president, Joachim Gauck, said that we needed migrants to get rid of the idea that being German means being white and being Christian. So there is a very clear ideological drive here to inject new populations into Europe in order to change the structure of those populations. And that is part of the European dream. It's part of the post-national European dream.
But it goes very far indeed.
And that's why I say Europe is not the answer.
How would that make Europe better? I don't get it, okay? I travel through Europe all the time. I don't see it's improving. I see it's declining rapidly. Go ahead. Yeah. Finish up, John.
Peter, the Bolshevik Revolution didn't make Russia better, but that didn't mean that people didn't believe in it. They believed in it because it's an ideology. It's a post-national ideology which these people want to implement by replacing the population. In their crazy minds, that's what they're doing.
Okay, Roland, you know, Italy has been hit very hard by this immigration crisis, we can use that word. I mean, shouldn't Italy on its own be able to decide what happens with inside its borders? I mean, why is it waiting for Merkel? Why is it waiting for Brussels? Why is it waiting for this summit that's going to happen in the weekend? I mean, Italy's a sovereign country. It should take care of its people first, particularly it's the unemployment of its youth, which is critical right now. Go ahead, Roland. Italians have to decide for themselves. Go ahead.
Well, that is exactly what is happening now after the last elections of March 4. We had the biggest shift to the right ever in post-World War II history in Italy. And in fact, the new government is blocking NGO ships, saying they are not democratically controlled. The new government is seeking the participation of Spain and is putting Merkel, especially the German Chancellor, under strong pressure to find a different solution. The only solution that is needed in Europe is to control the outer borders. We have to retake control, as European Council President Donald Tusk of Poland stated already in 2014, we have to regain control of our outer borders.
Yeah, but what about Italy's borders? Yep. What about Italy's borders? Isn't that the first thing you should be thinking about first? Sure. As an Italian?
Sure. The sad thing is that in this point, you are absolutely right. Italy is forced to take control over its own borders, made more or less alone. Why? I give you the example. Frontex, which is the official agency of border protection in Europe, is based in Warsaw and features 404 collaborators to protect the whole of the outer border of Europe. And has a total budget of 281 million, which is one hundredth of what Germany alone spends per year for the refugees, which is a disproportion that cannot be upheld.
We disproportion? Need that's an understatement, my friend. That's an understatement, okay? Wow, that's amazing. Let me go to Ralph here. I mean, Ralph, if we could put aside all the ideology and all of the virtue signaling, what some concrete things to do? In the United States, I think there should be built a wall. Then there won't be any children torn from their parents, okay? It won't happen. What can Europe do as a first step in your mind, a practical step?
Well, I'm from West Berlin, and I know how it is to live on an island surrounded by a wall, and we don't want to see walls anymore. But I understand that in the United States it's a different story. And, of course, the wall that we had was to keep people from fleeing from their country.
Yep.
Not into a country. So it's a bit different, of course, to compare these two walls. Generally, I think there should be better ways. Now, we as Europeans, we should commonly discuss how we can make life better in countries where migrants have to leave their country because they feel not safe. The second point is we can, of course, improve things in those countries by renegotiating the EPA, the European Partnership Agreement with Africa. I've spent a lot of time now in Africa at the moment, and
Ralph, we're almost out of time, but one thing the West could do is stop bombing those countries so these people won't flee, okay? Right. That would be a first good practical step. We've run out of time, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Paris, Bolzano and Regatta. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.